Calling to order the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. First item on the agenda is a report from the Crime Victims Criminal Records Division. Representative Lesh, please come to the table, and Representative Ward, if you would come to the table as well. Representative Lesh, we don't yet have a quorum, so we're just going to have you report and have Representative Ward present his bill, and then we'll move forward when we get a quorum. So Representative Lesh.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. We did pass House File 116, Representative Ward's bill, and referred it back to Representative Hilton's committee, this committee. Essentially, we heard from many testifiers who indicated that the 2008 law changes relating to Type 3 vehicle regulation were too onerous and restrictive, and they removed many opportunities that these school children would otherwise have had to get themselves to extracurricular activities and after-school sports. After those things, we did pass the bill with a voice vote unanimously. So.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Ward, do you want to go ahead and describe the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'll just talk about House File 116. Today is one of those days when you have the opportunity to make a positive difference for our children in the state of Minnesota. Legislation was passed to address safety issues surrounding Type 3 school vehicles and Type 3 drivers. It required drivers to comply with a number of requirements which came from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, including a physical and drug test. Previous authors of the bill, Representative Bingham and Senator Osteen, intended to exempt school employees who are temporary or incidental Type 3 drivers from the physical and drug test requirements through language referring to, quote, normal duties. However, the term normal duties was interpreted by the Department of Public Safety differently than the legislative intent of the authors. The Department of Public Safety's interpretation requires school districts to have anyone who may possibly drive a Type 3 vehicle meet these requirements, even though as regular school district employees, many requirements have already been met by regular employment with the school district. This significantly placed significant financial hardships on many school districts in the form of an unfunded mandate. House File 116 attempts to fix this problem while still protecting the safety of our children. And I want to emphasize that, while still protecting the safety of our children. It will bring back the law to its original intent by requiring that anyone who is employed for the sole purpose of driving a Type 3 vehicle must meet all of these requirements. Madam Chair, that's the thrust of the bill, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. I do not. There may be some testifiers in the audience, but I do not have anybody to testify today unless you'd like to hear from some folks.
All right. Thank you. I will officially call the meeting to order, and we do now have a quorum. And first, I need an adoption of the report from the Crime Victims and Criminal Records Division. So Representative Lesh would move the division report on House File 116. Let's see. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. And Representative Bingham.
Madam Chair and Representative Ward, you are correct. This was my original intent of the bill. There was a lot of discussion in the office, especially for some of the rural folks that are on the committee about this. But I just wanted to say I do believe this is a good bill, and I have heard back about positive results of the bill as it is now. From areas that are able to adopt to some of the language that's in this. But I do support your bill, and I appreciate you taking over on this topic, and I hope it has the committee support.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Keeping in mind that this bill was heard in the Crime Victims and Criminal Records Division, and we don't want to repeat the testimony here. Seeing none, Representative Lesh moves that House File 116, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended referral to the K-12 Education Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ward. Is Representative Leader here? I believe, Representative Olin, you had a motion.
Yes. I will move House File 980 be approved and referred to Agriculture Finance.
Policy. would be the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Committee. Thank you. Representative Leader, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Leader, and I'm here to discuss House File Name 80, which is a peace officer licensing bill. It's a reciprocity bill for reciprocity for examining for the peace officer. Actually, as you know, every peace officer is licensed in the state of Minnesota. And what this would do would allow, right now, a person with military, 5 years of military experience as a basically military police or law enforcement is eligible to take the exam. This would provide that a person that has gone to the academy in the military, which is roughly a two-year academy for military police, and if they have 3 years military service in law enforcement, would make them eligible to take that exam. And it also allows for reciprocity with the peace officer that was licensed in another state and had some active duty time in the military law enforcement. And the way you can tell if they're eligible is the military has what they call military occupational specialty numbers. So it wouldn't just be somebody that would be in the MPs maybe pulling guard duty or something. They actually have to be trained in law enforcement in the academy. And their military occupational specialty number identifies those particular individuals, so there's not a problem with identification. And basically, that's about the bill, Madam Chair. I do have the police or the law enforcement people and state patrol could testify, but basically, they approve of it because they think it would give some diversity to their applicants and be better for law enforcement people.
All right. Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Olin renews his motion that House File 980 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Tamar, I believe you're next. Representative Tamar, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I would. I'd like to move House File 180 and ask that the committee lay it over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. I do have an amendment that I would like to offer to get it in the shape that I'd like it, which is the DE2 amendment.
Okay. Representative Tamar moved the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the order that the author would like it. Members, I just wanted to let you know that we do have a 24-hour rule, and technically Representative Tamar didn't get to the 24-hour rule, but we consulted with the Republicans, and they are fine the 24-hour rule being waived. So, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Tamar.
Didn't I get it, didn't I?
No.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay, Representative Tamar.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, this bill is basically does three very simple things. It amends Chapter 626.74 under the section on peace officers, and this was the recommendation that came from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association under, and I won't go into great detail about it, but it has to do with individuals who are not law enforcement being able to carry firearms, and in researching this statute, the Sheriff's Association found that things have changed over the years, and now sheriff's office oftentimes use what's similar to a correction officer in the prisons. They now use what's called a detention officer. So this a detention officer wouldn't actually be a licensed police officer, but they are allowed to carry weapons. So this amendment would allow detention officers employed by a sheriff's office to carry a weapon. The amendment does the second part of the amendment, the delete all amendment. It changes a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor if someone has previously been convicted of impersonating an officer. And the final section of the bill, members, adds a new section to read that a peace officer who authorizes or knowingly allows a person to perform actions described in this statute is guilty of a gross misdemeanor. I think that's correct there on the amendment. I'm sorry, I have that mixed up there. So if a person has violated the statute and is convicted for a second violation, he or she is guilty of a gross misdemeanor, and a peace officer who authorizes or knowingly authorizes a person to violate this statute is guilty of a misdemeanor. And the purpose for the three portions of this bill and this amendment, Madam Chair and members, obviously the Sheriff's the Sheriff's Association wants this definition changed. The second thing is to recognize the seriousness of someone impersonating an officer. And the third thing is that we want to make sure that our sheriffs and chiefs of police understand that only a licensed police officer can perform police business. Part of the motivation of this bill was a situation that came about in my county where the Ramsey County Sheriff hired a non-licensed police officer and had him assigned to the Special Investigation Unit where he was responsible to do police work. This individual was a friend of the sheriff who admitted that he hired this individual who formerly was a public information officer and then assigned him to this investigation unit. You may have read about this unfortunate incident, but this individual has since been convicted of stealing money. So the intent of the bill is to, this section of the bill anyway, is to hold police chiefs and sheriffs accountable for hiring non-licensed individuals to do police work. I would submit, members, that in my county, the liability to our local jurisdiction if this individual had discharged a firearm while doing his work would have been monumental. I originally had this as a gross misdemeanor, and we settled on a misdemeanor. As far as I know, the cost from would be minimal. That's why it would stay in your committee, Madam Chair. The Post Board drafted the bill. The Sheriff's Association offered the amendment on the jail procedure, and the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association endorses the bill. And I would stand for questions. Neil Melton from the Post Board is here if you have any questions. I think Jim Franklin was supposed to be here if you had any questions on the sheriff's end of it.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymer, have there been other incidences other than the one you just indicated as far as the need for this bill? I mean, I can see where a specific incident, but if it's an ongoing thing, then I'd be interested to know.
Representative Paymer.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. This is the first, incident, obviously, in a large metropolitan area where this got a lot of attention. My hope is that it's not. My sense is that it's not. But we have 87 counties out there, and we have 87 sheriffs and many police chiefs. And I think I think hopefully we learn lessons from this incident, and that's why we've. Yeah. So I really don't have any research on that.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Paybar, does the Sheriff's Office or the Sheriff's Association or the law enforcement have any could they give us any type of enlightenment on that, or would they not know?
Representative Kamar.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't know that they would know. The Sheriff's Association, you mean? I don't know, and I don't know if the Chief, if the MPPOA would know either, and I don't know if Mr. Melton would know. He probably would say it probably rarely would happen, but it did happen in Ramsey County. That's all I can say. So, if you'd like Mr. Melton to come down, we can certainly ask him. I don't know. Originally I had, if you look at the original bill, I had really requested the Post Board to do much more oversight over all of this, and they have since said that they it would be too costly for them to do it, so that oversight area, we decided to not do that and instead just draft a simple amendment to it. So maybe Mr. Melton can help us out here.
Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Neil Melton. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. And I've had many conversations with Representative Paymar about this. And the language on line 1.12 says a person who is not a peace officer. We took that to mean any peace officer, so it doesn't have to be a chief or a sheriff or a state agency director. I am familiar with one other incident in Minnesota in the last 5 years, and that was a peace officer who loaned his badge and gun to his cousin so his cousin could go terrorize an ex-girlfriend. And so that would fall into this category as well.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair and Representative Kamar, I was familiar with the main part of the bill when it was first presented, but I'm wondering about the on the delete all 1.7. Unless the individual has been licensed under 626-84, 626-83, to do with the peace officer, I don't know if jailer is defined in statute, and the problem I'm having is that peace officers can carry firearms and certain people that are licensed and trained and use of force and this and that, but this just says jailer, and I'm a little troubled by that because there are jailers that are peace officers, jailers that aren't peace officers, jailers that are highly trained, and jailers that aren't trained for spit. So I wonder what that has to do, why a jailer is in there.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Franklin would be better to answer that question.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Jim Franklin. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. At the time we began to review this bill, we uncovered in reading this bill in great detail and in consulting with our legal staff that our response plans to riotous behavior, correctional inside of a correctional institution such as a jail, we have tactics and procedures for deploying of gas, perhaps rubber bullets, perhaps other types of devices, all of which fall under the category of a firearm. The other thing that's happened is that correctional staff in the correctional prison also, we use the same tactics, are authorized to use and deploy these weapons within a correctional institution or setting. The word jailer is defined in 387.14 specifically in the sheriff's statute that outlines what a deputy, a bailiff, a jailer, and other persons are in Minnesota statute. At the advice of counsel, the word jailer was put in here to denote and be prepared to deal with that type of situations that might constitute or necessitate use of force inside of a jail. So that's why in digging into this so deeply, we ran across that little quirk in the law, if you will, that has been there for many years. We just have not really caught it or paid attention to it, I guess is the best way to say it. We're trying now to correct it to ensure that everybody is covered. So they would be allowed to use these weapons under those circumstances in a jail type situation with a jailer involved in something like that.
Representative Cornish.
My concern is still that it's got or instead of and. I mean, it's been licensed under the statutes governing licensure of peace officers, and we all know that they can carry guns and train, but It says or is employed by a jailer, and so without the definition of the jailer here or seeing what type of training that the jailers have to submit to our correctional officers, and I'm just concerned that you're going to allow somebody to have possession of a firearm that's normally meant for security guards, you know, and peace officers that have special licenses and special training. So I'm just concerned that it says or and put jailer with nothing about the training that they have to undergo. I wonder if the post board could talk about jailer training, or if they're... Jailer doesn't necessarily mean that they've been trained for use of firearms, I wouldn't think.
Oh, and Representative Cornish and Representative Kamar, this is staying in the committee for possible inclusion, and so if you just want to lay out your intent, we can actually work on the language between now and putting together the omnibus bill, if that would be acceptable to both of you.
Sounds good to me.
Representative Kamar, is it your intent?
Yes, it is, ma'am. Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Milton, do you have something to add?
Madam Chair, I believe Representative Cornish wanted to ask me a question.
Representative Cornish.
Well, rather than ask the question, is if you and I and Representative Kamar could get together and talk about the qualifications of a jailer to carry a firearm and make sure that he or she undergoes the same training as a peace officer, somebody that's carrying a firearm, and what the term jailer means under that statute, that would be great to see.
We'd be happy to meet with Representative Cornish and make sure the definition is satisfactory.
Do you have something you wanted to add as well, Mr. Franklin?
I was just going to state that this would be consistent with the use of force policy that's currently in place under post. All the officers that would be trained to this level would have to meet the same current standards of use of force and use of force training that a police officer would go through.
All right. Thank you. Next is Representative Lesh. All right. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, my question was also answered.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over House File 180 for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Haymark. Representative Welty, are you ready? Representative Welty. I will move that House File 622 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. Representative Welty, please go ahead and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Andy Welty, State Representative, District 30B.
Representative Welty, you have an amendment. It is A090066, and I believe this is just... changing some terms. Do you want to talk about it at all, or should we just put it in the order in which you'd like it?
Madam Chair, if you'd like to move it at this time, I'll just quickly describe it to the member. Line 1.2 is essentially just a technicality. We're changing the word so that it's the correct word that's supposed to be there with the technology that we're describing in the bill. The other language essentially establishes that the task force that we are implementing is a voluntary task force, therefore per diem will not have to be paid, mileage will not have to be paid, there won't be a cost incurred to the state. line 1.8 of the amendment says that we're inserting some dollar amounts. Those dollar amounts are the dollar amounts for the, once the grant program is established, stating how much a local unit of the government could apply for and grant funding. So we're saying for a new lifesaver program, they could qualify for up to $4,000, and then if we're designating dollars to upgrade or to expand a lifesaver program, that they could qualify for up to $2,000. And essentially that is what this amendment does.
All right, well, I will move adoption of the A09-0066 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Welty, to the bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 622 is a bill that would establish a voluntary statewide advisory task force for a lifesaver program within the Department of Public Safety. The Minnesota State Patrol has agreed to be a convener of the voluntary task force. I've had discussions with them, and they are here in the audience today. and then also they'd be administrating the grant program when dollars become available in the state. My favorite programs, you're going to hear from a number of testifiers that will give you a very good outline of what we are talking about, but lifesaver programs have been implemented throughout states and local units of government throughout the country. The technology is proven, and it's very effective. Upon implementation of the program, lives will be saved, fewer families will grieve over a death of a child, parent, or grandparent, time spent searching for missing individuals will be greatly reduced, and emergency personnel and resources and dollars will be saved. Members, I'll quickly take you through the bill, and then the testifiers will come up. Subdivision 1 of the bill essentially just lays out the definitions and describes the program. It's the what we're doing is the Commissioner of Public Safety is going to establish the Lifesaver Grant Program and convene the task force. The Lifesaver Program is for individuals with medical conditions that cause wandering and results in many of these individuals becoming lost and missing. And so what we're trying to do is prevent people from becoming lost and missing. And unfortunately, some of these individuals, we don't have good outcomes. The other issue within Subdivision 1 is that we specifically state so we're targeting individuals with autism, Down syndrome, Alzheimer's disease, and then other mental impairments that cause wandering. Subdivision 2 is for the Lifesaver Advisory Task Force. The commissioner will appoint, and in the amendment it says that we amended it to be at least 5 members, and we're looking for those members to represent various geographic regions throughout the state of Minnesota. And we also want one member to have background with mental health. We also want one member to be a member of law enforcement, and then another member to have background in developing Lifesaver programs throughout the state. Just so you know, the language that you have in front of you is actually mirrored from language in Colorado. The state of Colorado has implemented a statewide Lifesaver program and grant program. Subdivision 3 is the eligibility for people and who can apply for these applications. We are specifically stating in this language that it's counties or counties and local units of government. We feel that that's the best route to go. In other states that have implemented this, they go by local jurisdictions, and counties are what we see is typically the local unit of government that takes this program on. The Subdivision 4 outlines the grant awards, and again, I described that already to you. If we're establishing a new Lifesaver program, they're going to be eligible for $4,000. If we're going to be expanding a Lifesaver program in a county or local unit of government, they'll be eligible for up to $2,000. And we are going to give priority to those implementing new Lifesaver programs. Subdivision 5 describes what the dollars are used for, and I want to be very clear. Counties and local units of government will choose whether or not to participate in this. If they choose to participate in this, what the Lifesaver program will pay for is the emergency response kit and the initial training for the officers involved. The grant recipients have to then provide for the operating costs after the program is developed. It's going to be very clear in their application process that this is only for the initial setup, and then after that they have to pick up the operation costs. Subdivision 6 allows the Lifesaver Grant Program account to accept private contributions or contributions other than the state contributions. Subdivision 7 will allow them to Department of Public Safety to have rulemaking authority essentially to establish the Lifesaver Grant Program. And finally, Subdivision 8 describes the itemization of expenditures and the report that the local units of government will submit after they have accepted grant dollars. And with that, that is the bill, and I will now allow the testifiers to introduce themselves and to share with the committee what this program is all about.
Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us. My name is Brad Trahan. I'm currently a co-founder with my wife, Joni, of the RT Autism Awareness Foundation in Rochester, Minnesota. It was only a few years back where a boy in Pennsylvania wandered out of his home who had autism in the wintertime, only to be found dead a couple of days later due to elements of the cold. My wife and I, we always wondered about recent fears. He's nonverbal, they have a high tolerance of pain, they can't difference what cold really could do and hurt them and actually take them to their death one day. So I approached our local sheriff and I said, if we got behind us as a foundation, can we bring agency called Project Lifesaver, can we bring it to our county? And we did that. In April of 2007, we implemented our program in Orange Bay County, and we're very proud that we have close to 50 applicants on the program. If you're 2 or 92, if you have autism, Down syndrome, Alzheimer's, if you may wander, you're eligible for this program. It's very important for this because, you know, as it relates to autism, in the summer of 2007, there's a boy in Wisconsin who was age 7, wandered away from his home, only to be found dead in a pond, 200 yards south of his home. The technology that we use, and will be later talked about by one of our deputies, is a simple transmitter bracelet. Our kids wear these. Our individuals wear these. Each of them has a frequency. We can track up to 1 mile on the ground, up to 1 to 2 and 10 miles in the air. And when the call goes out, our public safety departments come. They know who the individual is. They got pictures of them. They have a full application. They plug in this frequency. And it, with regards to our program, they're finding individuals in an amount of 30 minutes and less. And you know what's really neat about this program? Not only are they finding them on an average of 30 minutes or less, they're finding them alive. Our program that's been existing since 1999 that we work off of has already had over 1,800 searches, not one fatality. They've brought every loved one home. So it makes it easier on our public safety departments to be able to walk hand in hand with that individual rather than let them know that, you know what, your loved one's deceased. Now in July 2008, just last summer, we decided in Orange Bay County to put this into training. We took an 18-minute video for the community's sake and put it down to 2 minutes and 5 seconds. We want to share with you its effective. The moral of the story is from the time we did our training and the time they found our son through the same process, and when they left the law enforcement center to our home and found Reese was 25 minutes. From the time they hit our home to finding Reese, 9 minutes. But you know what's really neat about it? When we go out in searches, it takes a lot of people, thousands of people. But in this case, our team 1 consisted of 2 people and found Reese in under 25 minutes. Team 2 consisted of 1 person. We had 3 people find them in 25 minutes or less. It saves tax dollars, but more importantly, it saves lives. So, Madam Chair, if we could share the 2-minute and 5-second video with you at this time, we'd like to do so.
Please go ahead. If anyone has their cell phone on, if you could please turn it off.
So it means a lot as a parent to even see my son in those woods. It's just even envisioning that someday that could be Reese and his peers. I know we had a case in Wabasha County just a couple months ago where a mother found her child right by a pond ready to go in. Now that child is on Project Life with us. We have 50 on our applications, but we do all we can to serve our southeastern Minnesota area. I will say this, that we do have 9 agencies in the program in the state of Minnesota. We also have a couple agencies in Hennepin and St. Paul that have issued letters of intent, and I'm proud to also announce that hopefully by tomorrow we'll have 7 other counties funding that we've privately done to do our part to work with the Minnesota state government to also cover southeastern Minnesota as a whole. Any
questions from members? All right. Please go ahead. State your name for the record.
Jonathan Jacobson, the Olmsted County Sheriff's Office.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon. First of all, does anybody have any questions about the equipment itself right now? I'll go into a very, very brief detail of what the equipment is.
Brad, this is a technology's been around for a very, very long time. World War II, when the technology came out, and was being used for tracking endangered species. And now, since 1999, it's been used for human medical monitoring. Yes, the equipment is phenomenal. The product has been downsized for more portability. It's waterproof, or we call water resistant. Nothing is really waterproof. So we use this technology to track individuals with autism, Alzheimer's, and dementia. In Olmsted County, I have 49 clients on our program as well. In 2008, our Project Lifesaver Search team was called out 8 times. All 8 times, the child or the client was found prior to our team getting there. So the program is not just about the equipment. The entire program, what we call Project Lifesaver, and who we, as the Olmsted County Sheriff's Office, bought into, is the entire product, is the entire project of teaching us how to deal with those with autism, how to deal with those with Alzheimer's or dementia. So when we go locate these people, we can find and they can relate to us. The reason why law enforcement is involved and why I think it's important for a government agency to be involved in this, there's some steps that need to be taken by the family, by the caregivers. We need to ensure that the batteries get changed every 30 days to allow for maximum transmission of that radio signal, how we speak them. If this fell into the hands, I guess, of caregivers, one, it would be very expensive for caregivers to own their own piece of tracking equipment, but we're more readily available, law enforcement, firefighters, more readily available to go out in the house search. Not only that, but search and rescue is really more of a public safety type tool. And this just enhances our ability not only to eliminate the number of people that it takes to do a search and rescue. I'm not sure if any of you are familiar with the Keith Kennedy search last summer. In Wisconsin, back in Ann Arbor County, he was an adult autistic male that was wandered away from camp. Okay. It took 7 days to find him, and luckily, he was found alive. Very, very astronomical part of Project Lifesaver. Now, I'm not saying that Project Lifesaver would have found Keith Kennedy immediately, but it definitely would have helped. Okay? I think, you know, knowing how this product works, how we train our people not only to use the equipment, but how to deal with those with autism and other clientele that we're dealing with, definitely reduces the cost for public safety agencies, Red Cross, cost to volunteers that are coming from miles around to help in search and rescue. Brad, any other points that you'd like me to make? Any questions at all?
Questions from members? All right, seeing none, the next testifier, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, we'd like to introduce you. You just mentioned that Keith Kennedy, Keith's father, Bruce.
Go ahead, state your name for the record.
I'm Bruce Kennedy from Roseville. On Father's Day evening last summer, my wife and I were watching a DVD called Into the Wild when at 10 o'clock the phone rang. The caller ID indicated this call was from my son's group home in Shoreview. Something was wrong because I knew that Keith, who's 25 years old, wasn't at the group home. He had gone that day to a summer camp in Wisconsin for a week. We were concerned but not surprised to hear that Keith had gone missing from the camp. Keith had been dashing away since he was 3 years old. Because Keith has little or no sense of danger,
We try to keep him supervised just about every minute of his life, but because he's fast and doesn't care to be controlled, he will zoom away whenever he perceives open space. His communication is limited to describing what he wants at that particular moment in time. This made the search for him very challenging. No trace of him could be found, despite thousands of volunteers who tromped through the woods and swamps, enduring bugs and briars. In some cases, physical injury, in most cases, exhaustion. Professionals participated on horse with dogs, with high-tech equipment, planes, helicopters, computer programs, psychics, the works. There are fewer feelings for parents than your child being missing. Every thought goes through your mind. There's no rest. On Sunday evening, exactly 1 week after my son Keith disappeared, the sheriff coordinating the search told me with tears in his eyes that he couldn't find my son. I inferred from that that no more dollars on overtime were going to be expended on his behalf. While I pondered what to do next, there was a great hubbub in the camp. Word had come that he was found. St. Paul firemen had stumbled across him on their last mission. He was lying in the brush close to death, less than a mile from the camp. He was helicoptered to the U of M hospital where he was treated for hypothermia, dehydration, E. coli, and pneumonia, to name a few. But despite having only one kidney, a donated one, Keith is very resilient, and within a month he was back to normal, at least normal for him. Although it was a joyous event for us and many others who participated or followed the events, it's not something that we or anyone else would want to go through again. Aside from how we and others and Keith suffered that week, there was an enormous cost. According to the Burnett County Sheriff, the overall cost was $300,000 to $400,000. Just a portion of that was expended by him, but there were many other law enforcement and other professionals involved in this search. Neither Shoreview, where Keith lives, nor Ramsey County has Project Lifesaver resources available at this time. My wife and I hope that the right funding formula can be found to make such resources available to every Minnesotan who is at risk to get lost. Thank you.
Questions for members? Seeing none, Representative Welty, anything else?
Yeah, just some final comments on the bill for the members. We are leaving the light item blank that actually requests the dollars that we put into this. I'm realist. I understand that we have a deficit before us, so therefore we want to move this bill forward no matter if we have funding or not. We want to at least establish the Lifesaver Project Task Force, and the reason is that we do have about 10 counties on board right now, currently, Brad. We have 10 counties on board in the state of Minnesota. As more and more counties come on board, there are different technologies out there. And one thing that we want to ensure is that there's interoperability among the technologies that could possibly be implemented, so that if there is a search in a neighboring county, that county would have technologies that could be used or could be taken advantage of by the other counties if resources were called in throughout the state. The other issue is we just want to make sure that as the technology and as the players come together, there could be an opportunity for a regional type of approach rather than just a county-by-county approach. Some counties have kind of taken a look at shared services, and by having this task force in place, the voluntary task force, they could begin collaborating and coordinating these efforts throughout the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Welty. My understanding is that Olmsted County has this, is using this now and has used it. Do they have some kind of a protocol, or is there going to be a protocol that you're asking the Commissioner of Public Safety to establish in the way that we conduct these type of searches or the Lifesaver grant program? Is there a means by which it's going to be a statewide process? And I'll let you answer that.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative. what we're trying to do, what the language does in the, that we're proposing is establish the Commissioner of Public Safety would establish the grant program and then the parameters for that grant program that we have laid out there. As far as the actual program itself and the implementation of the technology, I mean, that's going to be county by county, and the training will be done as the counties enter into this. They get the dollars. Those dollars are then used to train the personnel. And so the task force, if there's guidance needed in how to implement that training, the task force working with that, the Department of Public Safety or the State Patrol can work out the details of that, of how the training is going to take place and who's going to do the training.
Follow-up, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Welty, does the county have to then apply to public, to the Public Safety Commission to request being a part of this, or is the Commissioner of Public Safety going to make a broad announcement to all agencies, all counties, that this is available, and then in turn have an application process, or what?
Representative Welty.
I think between the Commissioner of Public Safety or whoever's appointed from the State Patrol, and then also the task force, they can work out those details of if they're going to announce it. And they would announce it as soon as dollars were allocated for the grant program. Right now, we don't have that allocation for the grant program at this point, but one thing we want to at least have them move forward on is, one, you know, making sure that, that there is collaboration among counties that are currently working, and then if counties move towards this in the future, that there's some guidance given. The other thing, like I pointed out, there can be private dollars that go to this, so that can also expedite this program if the state dollars are not available. And then when those private dollars are put into the pot, those can be divvied out based upon the dollar amounts that we have there. And again, it's this task force and the appointed representative from the State Patrol that will be working on how this is administered.
One follow-up.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Welty, how many of these outfits like the emergency, not the advisory task force, but the Lifesaver program, how many companies offer this type of a little deal that go on your hand or in the state of Minnesota that are available?
Go ahead, state your name.
Jonathan Jacobson. There are two companies as of right now that actually provide equipment. Project Lifesaver is the only program out there that I know that teaches law enforcement and public safety personnel in the use, not only the equipment, but in dealing with patients with autism, Alzheimer's, dementia, and brain disorders.
And Ms. Madam Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Something was mentioned about Colorado having this program. Are there more companies in Colorado that are doing this?
Colorado is using the same program, Project Lifesaver, and I believe now the state of Colorado uses CareTrack.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Could someone answer me what the cost is that Colorado is incurring there with the project?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, not for sure about the cost. I do know that the cost that you guys are seeing here today would be the worst case scenario. As we try and do our stuff on the private sector, those numbers will go down. Right now, the program that we implement is per agency, $3,000 plus some expenses for the training. That's where you're seeing the $4,000 come into effect. But as we gain more counties on, while we wait and hope for governmental dollars, those numbers will go down.
Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Welty, this is a good bill. I really appreciate what you're doing here. I just, one question maybe to the Chair, just, what was the motion?
The motion is to send it to a policy committee.
Well, Madam Chair,
it's local, so it will need to come to you, I believe, after.
Well, that's what I was just confused about, because you've been referencing the State Patrol. So if the State Patrol is volunteering to do, did you say they were volunteering to do this?
They're here, they can. Yeah,
that's
discussion. You can clarify.
So if this is coming out of trunk highway funds, then would it go to transportation finance, or is DPS actually going to, when funds become available, are they going to administer the grant through the Office of Justice Program? Because then it would go the public safety finance. If it's coming from trunk highway funds.
Representative Tamer, it does just need to go to state and local first, because any task force that's newly created, it has to come. So whichever finance committee can have more than one. Go ahead. State your name for the record.
Mark Nasty, Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. Madam Chair, Representative, the Commissioner of Public Safety has asked the Minnesota State Patrol if we would oversee just the coordination of the task force, bringing this task force together, and then the minimum amount of time that would be utilized in the processing of the grant program. And typically in a program like this, our aviation unit works closely with a lot of the sheriff's departments on a lot of these search programs, and what we're going to do is we're going to put it underneath our aviation program, part of the process that we have over there. Although majority of it does come out of trunk highway, we also supplement that with general revenue and also some proceeds from forfeited drug encounters that we do with that. So I can't say specifically whether or not it's trunk highway or not. We don't anticipate we would start on a process of this. The commissioner just asked us if we would look at if we move forward with bringing the group together and having a conversation.
Representative Tamer.
Okay, well, maybe just between now and when it gets to finance, maybe Representative Welty, you can work with Representative Carlson and figure out where the money, because there's got to be some cost even to convene the task force. I mean, it's throughout the bill, it talks about administer and promote the grant program throughout the state, convene the task force. I mean, there's got to be some cost here, and then when grants are available, where would the grants come from?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that either. We don't know that right now. But, right?
Representative Welty.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymar, the grant dollars would come from either the state if the state designated grant dollars. Otherwise, the dollars can come from a private source. We have it written in sort of language that they can accept private dollars as well. So if the private dollars were to come in, that could initiate the startup of the grant program.
And so I don't want to confuse things, and we could talk about this later, but if it's most of the grant programs that I understand will come through the Office of Justice Programs through DPS, so it's kind of an odd animal we have here with the Department of Public Safety that part of it's in transportation trunk highway funds and part of it is state general fund dollars and federal pass-through grants, so we need to have an answer to that at some point.
Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 622 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the State and Local Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Welty. Next, we have Representative Kalin. Representative Kalin, it's my understanding that you'd like this to be laid over for possible inclusion pending a fiscal note, and then if there is a fiscal note, we'll be moving it to Representative Paymark's committee. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. I will move that House File 600 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have one small oral amendment. Mercurius actually has it, I think, in a written form as well. On page 2, line 9, the reporting of the use of the funds, currently the date is January 1st, there's just an oversight. We don't want folks on New Year's Eve or Christmas preparing the report, so I'd like to change the 1 on 2.9 to reflect to 15 to reflect the date of January 15th.
All right, the chair moves that line 2.9 be changed from January 1st to January 15th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kalin. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 600 deals with language that would merely add drug abuse intervention as an authorized use of drug fine activities. You might know these funds under the being used for DARE programs in your community. There are four counties, Chisago County being one of them, that have up and running juvenile substance abuse courts, juvenile drug courts, you might know them as colloquially. That program is an intervention. It's essentially a diversion program from juvenile detention and I think ultimately to jail or to DOC facilities. I've
visited juvenile drug court proceedings, the impact on not only the youth but also on the families is really constructive, and I know that it's not one size fits all, but I've seen it work very effectively to stop problems, especially drug-related problems that can turn into much more serious crimes. I think it's a cost saver. I think it's effective for our communities, and I think it's an appropriate use of the funds. With me is Steve McQuay, who helped found the juvenile drug court, and I think he can speak to the success of the program. And also, I would just point out that the drug court in Chisago County, the juvenile drug court, had to actually change their mission statement to kind of make a round peg fit a square hole. And I think changing the statute is probably a much more appropriate way to make sure that we're not forcing them to invent a mission statement, but that they're doing what we actually say that they should be doing.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Steve Pequay. I'm Court Service Director for Chisago County. I'm also an original member of the Chisago County Juvenile Substance Abuse Court Steering Committee. We've been operating a juvenile substance abuse court since 2004. Purpose of House File 600 is to amend MS 609-101 sub 3, that's the statute, which sets the minimum fines for serious controlled substance convictions and requires that 70% of the fine money be forwarded to a local drug abuse prevention program. This bill, which was originally submitted last year, was initiated by our Drug Courts Steering Committee, which seeks to expand the distribution of the mandatory fines to juvenile court programs, such as our juvenile drug court. These funds are currently only available to local DARE programs or to drug abuse prevention programs modeled after the DARE programs. The existing language already addresses any potential problems of sharing funds between qualifying programs by allowing the court to designate where the fines should go. We feel that expansion of the funding options is in keeping with the original intent of the DARE statute by focusing on juvenile drug abuse issues in the local community, and we're also being restricted by expanding access only to juvenile court programs. Our incentive for submitting this bill was to increase the options for the sustainability of Minnesota's four juvenile drug court programs. We hope that the passage of this bill will result in a new stable funding stream for these programs. Should make a note that I've already been informed by my drug court's coordinator that this bill is supported by the drug court coordinators of the other three juvenile drug court programs. Thank you for the opportunity. I'd be willing to answer any questions that I could.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will lay over House File. Let me get the number here. Sorry, Representative Kalin.
600 as amended, Madam Chair.
600 as amended for possible inclusion in the public safety amendment bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Next is House File 166, Representative Sanders. Representative Sanders, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's my understanding that the Civil Law Committee has requested your bill, Representative Sanders. So I'm going to send it to Civil Law because they've requested it.
Sounds good, Madam Chair.
So the chair moves that House File 166 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Civil Law Committee. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 66 is a bill that came from a constituent, and it addressed the problem that Minnesota is just one of a handful of states that does not explicitly ban the sale of recalled toys. And so what we wanted to do is solve this problem by prohibiting retailers from knowingly selling recalled toys for safety reasons by the federal government, the manufacturer, wholesaler, distributor, or importer, and then allowing the Department of Commerce to be charged with the enforcement of that and allow them to take action as well. So that is what House File 166 does, and I would stand for any questions.
Members, I just want to clarify the reason that it is here is because it creates a criminal penalty. There's a misdemeanor, and that's what this number 325F 5.16 is a consecutive. Questions from members? Representative Cass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question I have is, if it's a store that does like resale, so like a, you know, a Goodwill or any of those, Salvation Army, any of those stores, how are they going to get the access to information, and specifically then how long are those records kept for what toys are recalled and at what level and such?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Cass. The language in the bill that says that a retailer knowingly sells is a language that we worked out with secondhand stores and Goodwill thrift stores, allowing them to basically, if they don't know about it, we will not, or the Department of Commerce would not pursue legal action against them. So allowing them to kind of stand outside of that, because there is no way for them to necessarily know, same thing with even garage sales or something like that, statute would say any person. So the language knowingly, we believe, kind of satisfies that. As far as records go, I'm not entirely sure on how long they are kept. I really don't know.
Further questions? Representative Jackson.
This is a little follow-up. So then knowingly would refer to the manufacturer's notice that goes to retailers, distributors, importers, because that doesn't and can't go to the secondhand shops. It doesn't, and what I'm getting by that is if there's a recall that's, you know, in the Star Tribune, are people charged with notice just because it's been publicized, or is notice just that manufacturer recall notice?
Representative Sanders.
Madam Chair and Representative Jackson, from my understanding of working with the Minnesota retailers and the toy industry, is that it would be from the actual notices from the federal government, from the manufacturer, from the wholesaler, from the distributor, or the importer. So it must be an official recall from one of those departments or agencies.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sanders, is there an incident or things that have happened that brought this forward that you can cite for us?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson. I do not have any of the specifics in front of me today. However, there are some examples are some of the large retailers in this state as well as around the country. When recalls have gone out, they simply, in many cases, and even now in the state of Minnesota, are allowed to just put a sign on the shelf that says this product has been recalled. So they are allowed to leave them on the shelves. Now, a lot of stores, retailers do go above and beyond the current statute. They actually lock out the register, so you cannot purchase, the register will not allow you to sell anything along those lines. But statute does not say that they have to remove those items from the shelves. And the effort of this bill is just to make consumer protection for our children just a little bit more airtight. And it does line up with federal law.
Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sanders, this talked about commercial retailers. What about an item that was probably in the news a couple of years ago where a food service company, as a promotional item, is giving something away that would have been recalled? Is there any application of this to a free door prize, if you will?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Szymanski. The language in this bill does go after commercial retailers, and I guess I would leave it up to the Department of Commerce and the Attorney General to see if such circumstances would fall under the statute. But we are really going after commercial retailers and products that are for sale.
Further questions from members? Members, I need to ask a couple more questions. We just found out that the engrossment version of the bill didn't make it to us, and so it's being copied, and we have 2 minutes that we have to kill waiting for your engrossed version of the bill so that we can take care of that and send it on to civil law. So, 2 minutes, members.
Don't come and pull up the civil law.
my understanding that the amendment that was added, and maybe you want to talk about the change between what was before us and what was now, it's my understanding that it was not controversial at all, and that it did pass the Commerce Committee as amended without controversy. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is correct. And to be completely honest with you, I don't remember the exact change that were made. I've also been before the Labor and Consumer Protection Division before that, before we got to Commerce. So I think it had to do with amending or excluding the corrective actions clause.
It's here.
Okay.
We can take a look at the actual language. She just has one copy, so I guess it's going to be a few minutes. So why don't we just wait, and we're going to approve the minutes. So I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Less moves the minutes of Thursday, February 26th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And the second thing I'm going to do is I'm going to announce that we are going on a tour of the Shakopee Prison this Friday. We've now been to Willow River, the Sex Offender Hospital. We've been to Oak Park Heights and Stillwater, and the Women's Prison is next. So if you plan to go to that tour, make certain that the committee administrator gets your information. And I apologize, members, for not having a copy of the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, this wouldn't be a part of freshman hazing, would it?
No, actually, it wouldn't be. It feels a little more like chair hazing, I think. Madam Chair, Representative Jackson.
For Representative Sanders, just out of curiosity, is your relatively new fatherhood, has that kind of heightened your sensitivity?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Jackson, of course.
So how new?
He's 11 months old. Relatively new.
What happened to Ward?
And the bills are here. They are here.
What happened to Ward's blood pressure?
So I will wait until everyone has a copy, and then I will renew my motion that House File 166, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Civil Law Committee. Any concerns from members with the new language? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Sanders, and this meeting
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.